You're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel.
Morning,
and this
Amy.
Good morning, Greg. This is the podcast where we take your questions from Twitter that you send to us with the hashtag STRask. Thank you for that, by the way. And
yes.
Then we respond to those questions as
best we're
one
able.
Does. Okay, so here's a question from Andrew Sharp. How can God be loving when he allows Job to suffer so much, even though he was a blameless and upright man who fears God? Wouldn't a loving father want to protect his children?
Well, you know, this is a kind of objection that comes up, or a concern that comes up a lot. And it comes up from Christians and from non-Christians. And I think it suffers from a a truncated understanding of love and also the domain of God's love, okay? First of all, it presumes that that love never allows suffering, okay? So love doesn't allow suffering. God allowed Job's suffering, therefore God's not loving. Now, if you've read the entire book of Job, you know that there is a profound and life-giving message that comes out of the circumstance. And this message has been one that people have benefited from for thousands of years. Some people think that Job is the oldest book of the Bible. That is, it's the the one that was available in literary form first, even before the Pentateuch. Okay, here we have God acting in such a way to teach Job a lesson. Now, there are all kinds of times that loving parents either inflict pain or allow pain in order to teach a lesson that is a morally sufficient reason for allowing the pain. And so if our thinking is love tries to prevent all pain, which it was almost the way the question was worded, wouldn't a loving father try to keep his children from having pain? My answer is no, not necessarily. And if our questioner is a dad himself, he could easily look back at circumstances and say, oh, well, yeah, I guess I either allowed or caused some pain in my children's life for their betterment. I talk about this in the story of reality a bit, because it's not the objection against God. You know, would God allow evil in somebody's life? Pardon me. And the answer is, well, sure. A good God would do that. A loving God would do that if he had a morally sufficient reason. And then I give some illustrations, like taking my daughters when they were younger to get shots, and they don't like shots, and bad papa, you know, kind of thing. But I know the long-term consequence is going to be good for them, even though they're enduring a short-term amount of pain. And the same thing is true in Job. Now, wait a minute, long-term consequence. He was suffering for a long time. And then, all right, so he got his whole family, a new family back, and his money back, and all this other stuff. So at the very end, but still, he suffered a lot of loss. And this brings me to the second point. You have to think larger, okay? God is not just concerned with what Job is experiencing and what Job learns. He is concerned with the aggregate impact of good over time. And Bill Craig has pointed this out. I think it's really good that sometimes there are circumstances that we face now that seem to be evil for us, or that are hard and difficult and painful. And we do not realize that the aggregate effect of our experience here has some greater good down the line that may happen even after our lifetime. And I think of Squanto, actually, the story. Some of know the story of Squanto, which it's a Thanksgiving kind of – it's not just a story. It's an account of something that really happened. But here he lost his whole tribe. Well, what happened is he's kidnapped, and this is before the Mayflower incident. He's kidnapped, and he's taken to Spain and then to England, you know, basically as a slave. And he's allowed to return to America just in time to be there to save the Mayflower colony. And he walks into their camp and he starts speaking English to them, you know. And he's now attached to a different tribe because he found out that his entire tribe had been wiped out in smallpox, something like that. So it was a very terrible for him to be captured and carried away, kidnapped, terrible for him to lose his whole family. But that set up a set of circumstances that allowed something very good to happen. It's the thriving of the Mayflower community, lots of people's lives saved, an expansion of a foothold of God and God's word, and a promulgation of the gospel here in the New World. And so there's a, you know, a real life example of some bad thing that happened that down the line had a much greater good that resulted. And that's all that's really needed, morally sufficient reason.
I think our culture has a lot more difficult time understanding this than cultures past, because we have become such a culture of protection and safety, and above all else, that I think in the past people understood a lot better that the advantages that suffering and difficulties bring to you. So the first thing I would say is that I think we're looking at this from that perspective, and that makes it harder to figure out. But I'm thinking about Hebrews 12, starting in verse 4, mm-hmm. or starting in verse 5. You have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. So specifically because you are sons, he says, my son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons.
Not loved, in other words.
Right,
so
right.
The discipline is an evidence of the love, not an evidence of the non-love. And the discipline takes many different forms, which means allowing certain things to happen that are unpleasant in people's lives.
Yeah, and I think that can have many purposes. It can maybe it's because of sin, but maybe not. I'm thinking about 2 Corinthians 1 now, where Paul says, indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. So in that instance, they were suffering so that they would learn to depend on God and to trust that in the end he would raise them from the dead, and that there's a life afterwards with God. So God was teaching them to go into difficulties knowing that they could die, but still trusting him and still trusting that he would follow through with his word and take them to be with him. And so, I mean, and you look at Job, what happens at the end of Job? At the end of Job, he says, you know, I was just trying to find, I couldn't find the exact verse, but he's talking about how I thought I knew you, but now I've seen you. And he puts his hand over his mouth because he sees God's power and God's wisdom and all these things that God declares about himself, of how he knows all that's going on, how he's created all these things, his power, his glory, his majesty. And so at the end of the book, Job sees God much more clearly than he did before. And that's God's whole goal. His goal is not our comfort. His goal is for us to know him and to trust him and to be
and
shaped.
Be like him. But that's where you were going. Be shaped.
Yes. That is his goal for us. That's, in fact, in Romans 8, everybody knows the verse. You know, all things work together for good for those who love God. But what they don't know is the next verse talks about how God's shaping us to be like Jesus. That's right. His goal. Right. And to do that, we often will suffer. Mm-hmm. And so the last point I want to make is that, again, in this culture, this is difficult for us to understand because we have it so good here. But there are two things that every Christian eventually has to wrestle with and understand. And the first thing they have to make peace with is the idea that God will not stop bad things from happening to you. I think a lot of Christians, we start off in this life, we start off as Christians and we think, now God's going to protect me. He's going to keep all these bad things from happening to me, and I can trust him because he's going to protect me. Well, the first thing you figure out is that no, bad things will happen. Bad things will happen. This is a fallen world, and God actually uses
and this
those
catches
bad
a lot of Christians by surprise, unfortunately, yes. And causes them to doubt the wrong
and
view.
I think a lot of the reason why that is because churches do not teach Christians about suffering. They need to do a much better job teaching Christians that they will suffer and how to suffer well. And I think we are so focused on our best life now that we miss that. So the first,
By the way, Greg. I just wanted to add, I think that the hymnody of the past reflects this. And the popular worship music of the present does not. Mm-hmm. And so we end up, instead of reflecting on life as it really is and focusing on God and God's purposes, which the older hymns used to do, we have a false sense of triumphalism, and everything's triumphal, everything's wonderful, and yeah, we're all praising God. And when in fact, that just isn't the way it works. And so I think a lot has to do with our church life that, as you're pointing out, encourages that, including worship, which is one of the reasons why the older songs are so helpful. They are more substantive and more realistic about this.
Mm-hmm. So once Christians make it through that point where they realize bad things are going to happen, now this is where the danger is, because either you will reject God and walk away, or you'll spend some time in that place where you feel completely unsafe and you don't know what it means to trust God. The second thing you have to figure out is, what does it mean to trust God even knowing bad things will happen? Mm-hmm. And what does it, and I could say words right now, but I think this is something people have to just figure out. I think this is one of the things God is teaching us through suffering, is to trust that God, you know, Philippians 4, when Paul says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, trusting that he will get you through these things, trusting that he's still good and doing a work in your life and resting in that, even facing suffering. I mean, these are all things that I think we learn from suffering, but until you get into that second thing, it's a really hard place to be when you realize that you can't count on bad things not happening mm-hmm. to you.
This is where the Psalms, I think, play such an important role, because so many of them, I'm thinking right now of Psalm 13, so many of them engage the reality of suffering in a very, very authentic way. So it just occurred to me, though, that things are actually a little worse than the way you're describing them in terms of our understanding right now, because the culture has an attitude. It's one thing to say, why do evil things happen to me? Okay. And those are classically evil things, illness or accidents or whatever. Now, evil is described as me not getting my way, me not having whatever pleasure I want to have in the moment. And so it's very popular now for skeptics or challengers to say to Christians, if God won't let me have sex any way I want it, at any time I want it, and he's restricting the expression and experience of my pleasure, then he's a wicked God. And so now it's even gotten worse. It's not just the genuine problem of evil. Now it's, a certain sense, the problem of good, where God requires us to be good. And so that's evil, because he's mm-hmm. not allowing us to do whatever we want. How could God do that? Right?
Yeah, you're right, Greg. You're right. So, this is interesting times.
Screwy culture.
One thing I found, I think if anyone knows a Christian who has suffered a lot in their life, there's so much wisdom in that person. I just love to talk to people like that and learn from them, because there's a depth to their relationship to God that I envy and yet I don't want because mm-hmm. I know how they got it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we pray with fear and trembling when we ask to know God better, because the ways he does that are not usually very fun.
Yeah. By the way, in 1976, some people already know this, but I spent a summer in Europe in 5.5 weeks behind the Iron Curtain when there was an Iron Curtain, working with Christians in clandestine enterprise. I was 26 years old, who were suffering for the Lord. And these folks were oppressed. People talk about oppression in this country. They have no idea what they're talking about. They're inconvenienced in some way, and so this is oppression. But these people were oppressed, and they had suffered significantly for Christ. They had been beaten. They had lost members of their families. Their children were taken away from them. They were in the gulags. Yet these people have, as you pointed out, had a tremendous substantive Christianity and depth with God as a result of what they had to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. Paul, 2 Corinthians 4.
All right, let us go to a question. I'm trying to decide which one to do here. Mm. here's a question from Paul. How do I answer the challenge that Jesus may have just had a near-death experience and returned to his physical body a few days later?
Well, the simple way of putting that is, what would make that person think that that's exactly what happened? Okay. What near-death experiences are where a patient is under medical care. Not this isn't always the case, but it's often the case, medical care, or maybe they have a trauma of an accident, okay? And they are dead for by one reckoning, whether it's a flat EKG or a flat EEG, they're flatlined. And which that's what death is, at least two definitions of it. The third one has to do with biological. Your body's like beginning to rot, okay? They have this short-term death experience, and then they are either revived or they come back, okay? And it's a short-term, and they can relate what happened to them personally while they were gone, as it were. So that's a near-death experience, an NDE. Okay. There are no near-death experiences that last for 3 days. And the reason is, when you got a flat EKG and a flat EEG for even more than, you know, a few hours, your body begins to decompose. It starts going through all of these stages. Jay Warner Wallace talks about this, for example. You know, the blood pools in a certain way in the body. It goes to the extremities, so gravity pulls it down. So therefore, and part of his point is, the people of that period of time, they were familiar with what happens to bodies after they die, because it was their job, individually, the family's job, to care for the body. And so there was no question about whether that body was dead. In the case of Jesus, by the way, if we follow the historical record, and that's what's in question here, Jesus appeared to be dead by the Roman soldiers, not like the thieves whose legs had to be broken in order to hasten the suffocation that is ultimately the result of crucifixion. Jesus was gone. But just to make sure, they thrust a spear through his heart, just checking. And then the family members took Jesus down from the cross, and this isn't the first burial they've been involved with, because the family always buried the family members who were involved in washing and cleaning the body. And then, according to the text, about 75 pounds of herbs and spices were added to Jesus' body as part of the embalming process, and he was wrapped up and clothed in a shroud. and then laid in a cold tomb for 3 days, essentially. And so the question is it reasonable under those conditions for a person who went through the physical trauma that Jesus went through for him to survive, even though he might have died for a moment or a few minutes or for a few days and come back? So the circumstances of his burial indicate he was dead. All leading up to the burial. And the idea that he suffered so much physical trauma, it's hard to imagine anyone's going to survive that, especially waking up in a cold. Jesus was laid on rock, all right? His body was laid on rock. This is April, all right? It's cold. And is it reasonable to think, well, he just popped back to life again, somehow removed that stone, overcame the Roman soldiers, and then appeared to his disciples as the Lord of life? All right? When they saw him, and the description of him appearing in different places in different ways is clearly supernatural, they didn't say, hey, he woke up.
Let's get him some help.
Let's get him some help. We get bandage the wounds, you know. So there is nothing about the historical record that supports that possibility. Mm-hmm. The principal thing here is that it wasn't like a standard NDE. Jesus was down for at least 36 hours. Maybe, let's see, 30, no, more like... at least 36 hours. And if he actually was crucified on Thursday instead of Friday, which some people think, then you have even more time there. So has to do with how the Sabbath stuff works. But there's some conjecture on that. In any event, he was down long enough that he's not going to survive from a standard NDE. It's just not a reasonable thing to believe. Why would anybody believe that?
And even if he revived, he would still have all his wounds. He would still have... You know, you just pointed this out, Greg. He wouldn't look like he had a resurrected body and walk out of the tomb and all these things. He even if he just regained consciousness, would he have done? He would have just been still there in the tomb, and that's it. So
people who have NDEs on the operating table don't pop up off the table and say, "Okay, see you later. I'm going to go out and shoot some hoops."
All right, Greg. Well, we are out of time for this episode. Thank you for your thoughts.
You're welcome.
And I think that's it for today. But thank you again, everyone, for your questions. Please keep sending those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.